Beer Talk. Gespräche über und beim Bier.
Hello and welcome to another episode of our podcast Beer Talk. Today I'm still in Poland, meeting great people from the brewing world, and now we are a little traveling to the United States and meet Jamie Bogner. He has also a podcast, but also a huge magazine for brewing, home brewing, and other things. So we'll talk about that in a moment. It's great that you are here, and maybe you can introduce yourself a little to our listeners.
Sure, thank you, Marcus. I'm Jamie Bogner. I'm the co-founder and editorial director of Craft Beer and Brewing magazine and host of the Craft Beer and Brewing podcast. I live in Fort Collins, Colorado, in the United States. I've been a big craft beer fan since 1995, when I turned 21 and could finally legally consume beer in the United States. And the magazine has been around since late 2013.
Wow. And you live in Fort Collins. So in terms of the weather here in Krakow, we now have around zero. Yesterday it was a bit snow. What is the weather around in home?
It's a little warm for me here.
Okay.
I can walk without a jacket and be just fine. We have good, beautiful mountains in Colorado and have plenty of snow now up in the mountains. I live at about 5,000 feet of elevation, so, 1,900 meters. So I live at a good elevation, and the mountains go up from there. But it's a beautiful place in our town of 150,000 to 180,000 people. We have 25 breweries.
Wow.
And the city produces about 10 million brewers barrels of beer per year. So, it's significant. What hectoliters is, 11.5 million hectoliters. We have a large Anheuser-Busch brewery that does most of that.
Okay.
But New Belgium Brewing, Odell Brewing, and some very large craft breweries too. And then some very small craft breweries.
So a little beer mecca.
It is a wonderful place for us to be located with many, many smart brewers.
And I think Rootshoot Malting is also in the area, I think.
Rootshoot Malting is about 20 minutes south of my house, yes. And we also have Troubadour Malting right there. And Grouse Malting is they produce gluten-free malt, and they're one of the biggest gluten-free malt producers. They're just north of Fort Collins in Wellington. So we are right there, the interface of farmland and mountains. And so there's lots of agriculture and lots of people that make things with that agriculture.
Wow. Yeah, I had the guys from Rootshoot Maltings also on the podcast. That was great. They told a lot about the landscape and everything.
Sure.
And breweries.
Todd and Mike.
And we can just dive in a moment, as you said, gluten-free malt, because I can't imagine many of our listeners just have some question marks in their head. So can you say just quickly, what is a gluten-free malt?
Well, gluten-free malt, obviously it's malt made from non-gluten-containing grains.
Ah.
And so Grouse Malting has been around, 9 or 10 years now, and started very small, but has grown significantly. And they're using malting a number of grains, again, that don't contain gluten, but that can actually produce good tasting beer. And so there's some major non-gluten beer brands like Ghost Fish, which is based up in Seattle. There's another one, Holidaily in Golden, Colorado. And a lot of these breweries that are making gluten-free craft beer rely on Grouse Malting for malt that can make beer. Because it's one thing to reduce gluten in a beer using, say, Brewer's Clarex, Clarity Firm, or another chemical like that. But you can't call it gluten-free if it starts with gluten-containing grains.
Yeah.
And these breweries want to be 100% safe for those with a medical condition like celiac. And so in order to be 100% safe, they can have no gluten grains in their facility. And they count on Grouse Malting to produce malt that can make interesting, flavorful beer and work within the confines of a technical brewery.
So that's something like buckwheat or something.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Very interesting. Thank you. So now let's talk a little bit about you.
Sure,
sorry.
Sure.
I was just because maybe people have these question marks and we should go right there.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe before we start talking, of course, we should start drinking because we are here for of course, a beer competition and a beer conference, and we're talking a lot about beer, and you never can talk about beer without drinking beer. So
it's the name of your podcast, yes, right? Beer talk, but you talk over beer also.
Yes, especially. So we have 6 cans now here. You brought 3 from a Polish brewery, and I stole 3 others from other Polish breweries yesterday at the conference. So free choose. What do you think?
Later on, we're going to have to try the Rauch beer because, I have to hear your thoughts on it. But maybe we would start with Desika.
Perfect.
A small lager.
Sounds good. So, oh, you have a great, great glass mug. Is it also from here?
This is also from the same brewery.
Nice.
I visited a few breweries in the 2 days before the competition started here, and so made a visit to Wrocław and saw brewery Stu Mustów and also Vidava,
mm-hmm.
and then took a train down to Bielsko-Biała and visited with Pinta and Bart, and then we drove up to Moonlark and picked up Pavel, and then drove to Krakow, and so here we are. So I got to see the brewery, and then of course Pavel from Moonlark, and was on my judging table on the second day of judging at the competition.
So the audience now knows you are a professional. That's how. Cheers!
Cheers!
Yeah. So this beer is from the Moonlark Brewery, you just told us, and it's called Digit. Dizitka. And does it say anything about the...
It's a 10-degree beer.
Just a nice, easy-drinking lager.
Czech, Polish, somewhere in there. Yeah. Definitely a strong hop character in the more Czech tradition.
Also a little nice malt base, so quite balanced. I like it. Nice mouthfeel. So a great start.
Good.
Thank you. Thank you for this. So fantastic.
As an American, I enjoy lots of bitterness. And so we have an affinity for the Czechs in that regard.
Yeah. Many bad German jokes would now say, should we add some water to your beer? But, you know, sorry. So let's talk a little bit about you. So you grew up also in Colorado or somewhere else?
I grew up in Central Florida.
Oh,
The home of Disney World, and lived there for most of my life. Went to college in Memphis, Tennessee, home of the Blues, and then moved back to Orlando and then New York City for 10 years. And was in New York City from 2001 to 2010.
Mm-hmm.
I've worked for my entire career in media, mostly magazines, but also web, digital, and I have... in a volunteer capacity for many years, worked as a radio DJ in college and community radio stations, and DJed in Orlando as well as in Memphis, Tennessee. Got away from that in New York City and then came back to that through podcasting back in 2017 when we launched our podcast. But lived in New York City for 10 years and had both of my children were born in New York City. And then in 2010, we moved out to Colorado. Company I worked for had a headquarters. They were bought and had headquarters. Mm-hmm. They offered me a promotion to move to Colorado. And I thought, I'm going to say yes to that.
Yeah. And maybe you already heard it, but you have a great radio voice.
Well, thank you. As do you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. That's great to have some identity also voice-wise, so that's perfect. As you said, you were in New York in 2001, so you had the 9/11 thing, or you've been
there? Yes. Yeah, that was a difficult time. We moved in May of 2001 and lived in Long Island City, Queens, or actually lived in Sunnyside, Queens, just in the city, but across the river from Manhattan. And so I was on the subway platform to head to work at 8:45 that morning, and out there the subway platforms are above ground, and so my wife called and said, you should, the plane just hit the World Trade Center. And so I walked down to the end of the subway platform, and sure enough, you could see the World Trade Center and smoke coming off of one of them. And you know, and so people started talking, like, you know, and of course no one knew what was happening then. And then by the time the subway came, we kept watching it through the windows until we, right before we went underground, saw the other tower. And it, we, again, you couldn't tell that it was another plane. Like, we just saw another explosion. Like, well, what was that? And but then got when I, by the time I got to the office, everyone was standing and watching the televisions. And that was a really difficult day. They ended up shutting down all of the public transportation. So after an hour, after we walked, after the first tower collapsed, everyone just left.
So you could get home, or
we had to walk home.
Walk.
And so I walked home from Central Manhattan up to the 59th Street Bridge, over the bridge, and all the way home. You know, from there it was difficult.
Yeah, crazy times. So, and but glad that you came home safely. And yeah. But it's still, I was there.
It is nothing compared to what the Ukrainians are suffering through now at the hands of Russia. So all of this, you know, through the history of the world, there are many more horrible things. Not that this is not that we are comparing those things, but
But I think it was maybe the first event where more or less the whole world was watching at the same time, so just in a different time zone. But I also remember it was at home in the afternoon,
visiting
what happened, and we were all like stunned. And that was really, and that was there some years ago in New York at the World Trade Center site. And this is still heart shaking if you're there. So
I think the thing that I took away from all of my experiences, including that in New York, is that when things get hard, people pull together.
Yeah.
Even in New York City, even in a city that can be rough and tumble, that when people need things, the whole neighborhood helps. And that was a wonderful thing. We saw that through when the city lost power a few years later, the whole northeast of the United States power grid went down, you know, and the local neighborhood pizzeria that had gas but didn't have a cash register because they have no electricity. They could make pizzas. They didn't have refrigerators. They needed to get food out to people. They made pizzas. They just gave them away. You know, we saw the same thing after 9/11. People, you know, the community was wonderful.
Wow.
Yeah. People pull together when things get hard and they help each other through.
Yeah, and
Marcus, I didn't realize we're going to get so heavy in this podcast.
No, it's I think it's always important because having these experiences, it's part of our lives, and maybe you cannot really compare it, but a little bit. If we look into what's happening in the beer world right now, it's also a little bit that there is a lot of depression, a lot of loss of market shares, a lot of trouble in terms of prices, energy everywhere.
Sure.
And somehow on the fair in Nuremberg some weeks ago, I had a bit the same experience because I was thinking, okay, everything is going down. There will be less people. There will be less exhibitors. It will be all a big depression, and it will be all a very sad experience. And it was the opposite, because the people were more into coming together, into cheering together, into talking, helping each other. And I think this is, as you say, like a human reaction to stick together if there's trouble. And also it's something I always experience when I'm traveling with the beer world, that wherever you are in the world, when the beer people come together, it's like a family. And this is something that is worth a lot, and it helps a lot. And also when sometimes someone of us has whatever problem, we really help each other. And so I think it's the very human part also in the beer world, which is also making us maybe a bit different. So yeah,
it's a beautiful feature of the community of beer, and it's so constant wherever you are throughout the world. You know, this whole culture, and you know, I think that all of us who make things have a basic optimism. You have to feel that if you make things, whether you're making beer or you're making media, you're making magazines and putting these things out, that you have to have an optimism that tomorrow can be better than today. That we, you know, you have to. Like, that's just if you didn't, then you wouldn't feel any compulsion to make things. And so I think brewers by their nature, you know, have that kind of optimism. And I think that as challenging as, you know, this year, next year, even the year after may be in terms of some pullbacks, some declines, some rebalancing in the overall market, The wonderful thing I think about where we are now in the world of beer is that the quality is so high.
Yeah.
When I look at, in terms of the United States craft industry, the last time that experienced something like this, if you look the last time that the number of breweries in the United States decreased, the last time was 2001 to 2003. Mm-hmm. And they saw, you know, there were about 1,100, 1,200 breweries in the United States then. And they saw a net reduction over 2 or 3 years there in the total number of operating breweries. We actually still have not seen a net reduction now.
No.
We're still actually adding a few breweries, which is very strange, even though things are down. But the last time we saw that, you know, 22 years ago, the quality of the beer was nowhere near as good as the quality of the beer is now. And so I think to some degree, the focus on quality that the brewers around the world have focused on and breweries in the United States provides some higher floor. And I think that that raises just how far things could drop. That, you know, our ceiling might not be higher or as high as it once was, but I don't think we drop as far this time around. I think that we, you know, brewers still make such compelling beers in such quantity, you know, more and more breweries, especially in this craft sector, make such good beer that it's harder for it. It's, you know, if it was not as good, it would be easier for it to drop.
Yeah, and that brings us a little bit back to your history, because I think, especially if you look the beer quality in the U.S., there is a reason why it also is rising there, because there is more and more good beer media, so magazines, YouTube channels, podcasts, whatever, so that the word is spread more and bigger and wider, and also people are more exchanging their experience and raising the average quality. So how did that come to you, that you say, okay, now I do a beer magazine?
Well, I can't say that it's because of us. I can say that there is a... Oh, not at all, not at all. That brewers in the United States, after that difficult time period, committed to helping beer brewing in general in the United States get better and created a culture of sharing that we've been able to benefit from. It's not something we created, but we are a product of the culture itself.
Or part of the story.
I keep trying to be part of that story, yes. But if the culture, and there were some significant leaders of that who really focused on giving away information about how to make high quality beer, and then how to, you know, I've worked hard within industry groups to improve the quality of ingredients, to improve the quality of hops, of yeast, of malts, so that brewers had better tools. And the brewers, these highest quality brewers, really just shared so much. It has just built this wonderful culture. And so when we decided to start this, my business partner and I came out of another media business that was focused on handcrafts, all built around makers, but a different kind of maker that loved to sew, that loved to make jewelry, that loved to knit, fine art, painting, and drawing. And so we understood how to build compelling media for makers. And our thought was, what if we take what we know about media for enthusiasts and apply that to brewing, which is and beer, which is a subject matter that we were personally interested in. And so that was the genesis of it. And my business partner, John, actually came up, left the business we worked for, spent, a few months working on a business plan, you know, put some data together, convinced me to leave my job at that business. He was a VP group publisher, senior VP group publisher. I ended up with his job, VP group publisher, managing a $35 million U.S. unit, and, you know, 100 plus employees all working in this field. And I'll just tell you that managing people is less interesting than what I'd get to do now. So, so we put the business together. He put a business plan together. We decided to launch. He's like, I think in 2013, he's looking at the numbers. Like, I think craft beer is going somewhere now, and that will support the kind of business that we think we can have with this if we do this. And, you know, of course, there were no guarantees, but we are completely self-funded. We have no outside investors. We're 100% employee-owned, and we control our own destiny. And ours is also tied to, you know, craft beer itself, obviously, so significantly now. But that's how that got started. I did not know nearly as much about brewing as I do now, and had to learn about. I knew plenty about beer, and I knew far less about brewing. And so
does that mean there was a culture of making or of craft making before that craft beer culture came up? So it was, because sometimes I don't know if you know that fake movie about artisanal firewood. Yes, I will put it in the show notes. But my question was always, what was first? So was there general this thing of self-made things and the craft idea, or was beer leading this? Or
I think that craft beer hit right around the time where a lot of other things hit. You know, that this history of craft beer, I think it's impossible to take it outside of the context of things like farm-to-table food, of shopping at farmers markets to buy from, you know, growers, and you know, of artisanal coffee with you know, single origin beans and thoughtful roasting by local roasters for fresh coffee, you know, where you know where it came from. I think you know, culturally we all started wanting to get closer to the source. And I think that you know, from restaurants that were then starting to tell people which farm their, you know, the greens came from, or which, you know, farm that their, you know, pork was raised at, you know, that kind of general cultural consciousness was increasing significantly in the 80s and really hit ahead in the 90s at the same time that craft beer accelerated. And so I think the cultural trends are connected. I wouldn't pull them apart. While at the same time, because the beer industry in the United States was so dominated by large corporate manufacturers, we've actually had such an incredible homebrewing community that pushed creativity, but then also big competition. And, you know, that homebrewing world created so many brewers who were just primed to become professional brewers as the market continued, you know, the potential continued to grow for that. And then you had a recession in 2008, that put lots of people out of work. And you combine that with a whole bunch of inexpensive brewing equipment in the United States that was on the market still because of all of that pullback in the earlier 2000s. So you had access to cheap equipment. You had people who got laid off and had some money and like, well, I don't want to go back to my job doing that thing in the investment world. I want to start a brewery. And so, and they now had time, and you know, it was the beautiful foundation for this new resurgence that we saw in the early 20-teens in craft breweries, you know, in the United States, and, you know, of course, in lots of other parts of the world as well, right around the same time.
Yeah, and so you found that all about brewing. So what was the original idea? Was it just for home brewers, or was it for beer lovers, or both, or did you change the focus? Or
and pro brewers?
Yeah.
The answer to that is just yes.
Yes, okay.
What I find, Marcus, is that putting very tight definitions on things, drawing lines too closely, doesn't really help anyone. We didn't need to be a homebrew magazine. We didn't need to be a pro brew magazine. We didn't need to be a beer consumer magazine. I find that a lot of people I know are all three of those things, that pro brewers are also beer nerds and beer fans. Some professional brewers I know still homebrew in addition to, you know, working commercially there. Some are piloting on their own one barrel system at home. I don't find many professional brewers that also don't geek out about beer, you know. And so, you know, and then there's plenty of homebrewers that were on their path or would like to become professional brewers. What we decided to do At the time, most of the media was focusing on, it was too tightly aligned around that. And you had homebrew magazines that would make clone recipes where someone would try to copy, a recipe from a professional brewer. And our thought was, well, why try to copy that? Why don't we just go talk to them and get a recipe from them and work together to make the homebrew recipe so that it's something someone could make? And then, of course, other professional brewers could also look at that same recipe. Maybe they use it. We just don't put lines around that. But it also seems more interesting to tell the story of that brewery and get insight from them, because so much creativity had been driven by homebrewing for so many years, and that had been the source. But right around then, we started seeing some of that like significant creativity and respect, happening within the professional brewing world, in the same way that the entire world of celebrity chefs, was such a thing. Yeah. Like, we thought, oh, there's an opportunity here to focus on working with phenomenal world-class professional brewers and share their insights on brewing with the world and give them the kind of credit and the kind of platform and not just exposure, they have plenty of exposure, but celebrate them for the artists and the makers that they are. And that was important to us. And that is the strategy that we have taken ever since, and both within the magazine but also within the podcast.
Yeah, also I think it's a good idea to have a stage where you can present these brewers and give them the opportunity and help them in communicating. And before my next question, maybe we can taste the next beer.
Let's do that.
So, all right, which one?
I chose the first one. You chose the next one.
Let's see. Those I got were also some strange ones, but maybe that we do later, and that would be a challenge. let's have the IPA. It's a wheat India Pale Ale.
Sounds great.
I guess you already had it because it's on the competition, but let's see. From
Czech Complete?
Yes. So let's see. Here we go. Of course, it's cans.
What's wrong with cans?
Nothing wrong. I love cans. In Germany, we always have this discussion because we had the problem that we banned the can in the time when it was quite also a bad can, so having not metallic aromas and whatever. And then we didn't have cans for about 10, 15 years. And then the can came back as a tool for Prosecco. So for the expensive and special stuff. And it was never used for beer anymore. And that now slightly comes back into beer. So it comes from a different angle. So before it was the cheap, bad thing. Now it's the expensive and whatever thing. And the brewers, but most of the brewers come from the old times. So for them, it's still a problem. And I always say the can is the best for beer if you don't have a barrel. And the only thing is that you should use a glass. So don't drink.
That's such a Franconian point of view.
Yeah. That's the only thing. So, but, but it's nice. So a lot of smell. Cheers.
Cheers.
Fantastic. Yeah, we'll talk a bit about the Polish brewers in a moment. But first, because I also had the idea, or I more often had the idea to also do like a beer magazine in Germany. And then I had the opportunity that one of the existing ones was broken. So the idea was how to take it over potentially. And then I was analyzing the numbers and I found out it's a total mess because of the logistics and everything. And I think for us, Germany is quite a big country, but to have a beer magazine in the whole US with all the different states and that huge territory and things. So I really can't imagine how you can set up this totally on your own. So this must be like a 28-hour job for 24 hours or whatever. So yeah,
it's all, every new business and every small business is a challenge. We have about 13 employees now, and we had 9, 10, 11. Now we have 13. So it has grown over time. The first 5 or 6 years of the business, like every small business, you worry that you're not going to make it. And we definitely had some of those weeks and months. We're like, huh, You know? strange thing. I mean, it was an interesting effect of the pandemic, but we happened to be, we launched the podcast in 2017. And, you know, by 2020, here we were, strangely enough, in the business of sending things to people's homes, both magazines to people and, you know, as well as podcasts out there to them and their digital devices. And strangely enough, it was this connecting thing. And I heard that from lots and lots of people, like they listened to the podcast while working out, in their homes, and then felt connected to this other, you know, bigger world still through these kinds of things, you know, and the magazine continued again, even, you know, because we produce it in a very, slim and distributed way. And so that actually, weirdly enough, was positive for our business, and that we were in the right business of sending things to people's homes when that's exactly what people needed. I don't want to make light of the pandemic, because obviously it was a very serious, impactful negative, and many, you know, a million people died from this. It's nothing to make light of. But while it just wasn't as challenging in that regard, you know, just for our business because of what we did. I don't know. I lost my train of thought there.
But I think it's also,
there's no guarantees with any of this. But we've taken a very focused strategy. We also focus heavily on the business to business market because, you know, within the United States, it's not just the United States. It's also Australia. Australia is our second largest market. Canada is our third. UK is our fourth. There's a large English speaking audience in the world. South Africa is a significant part of our audience. And so, you know, across that, you know, we aggregate a good sized audience, and by focusing also on the professional side of the brewing industry, it's able to sustain the business in a way that if we were just focused on consumers, we wouldn't sustain a business like this.
Yeah, I think, and also just one word to the pandemic thing. I think it was as far as I know it from Germany, it was a special challenge also for people with a known company, like also myself, because of course we were able to do things and get through, but it was also a challenge of reinventing yourself, finding your niche. You didn't have any help from anyone and anybody. So I think the first weeks I was delivering beer and bread to people because I had a whole garage of beer, which I had for events, which never happened. So I had all these beer and didn't know what to do. And a friend of mine, she has a bakery. So we said, okay, let's make an online delivery for beer and bread. And I'm a journalist, so I was one of the few guys allowed to drive around. All the rest had to stay at home. So I could do this delivering. And that's, you make strange things in strange situations. And in the end, so that's how it went. But back to the podcast thing, I also had a nice experience. Some alumni from the Beer Academy started also a podcast like a year ago or something. And then they asked me if I would like to be in one of the first episodes. And then they said, yes, and we will have to buy all this software and hardware. And then we make these scripts, and then we have to learn the text, and then we have some music and whatever. And so huge things to do. And then I just thought back, okay, when I started my podcast, I more or less had a microphone. And that's it. And I never did a scripted thing because I just like talking as it is. How did you start? Did you have something like a professional approach with everything scripted, or was it more also radio-like? Or
I think we were never scripted, and sometimes we'd write out intros, but most of the time we would just wing it. I think that there's something to conversational style that is very beneficial in the podcast space. I don't love podcasts that lean towards like radio shock jock or, you know, group of like making jokes together. I'm not an entertainer in that sense. I am an interviewer, and I try to focus on the guests that I have. And then I think the biggest skill is All my pre-preparation, it was conversations, or that's why I try to do most in person, because I find that drinking beer with someone, walking through their brew house, being able to see where they brew the beer, being able to taste the beer that they brew, it raises lots of questions for me, and that becomes my preparation. You know, I do a little bit of research and you know, make sure that I have some general, and usually I know who we're talking, I'm talking to, because, you know, you don't just stumble into these things. It takes work. And, but through that, and then through very active listening throughout the conversation, I'm able to keep that going. There are certainly podcasts out there where they come with a list of questions, and I find that less dynamic. I love the, you know, achieving, finding things, finding topics, and working together with a guest to get there. That's more interesting, I think, to me than coming in with what I think I want to ask. When they say something that raises a question, that's where I try to drill down. And I think that's the feedback that brewers give me. Like, you asked the exact same question I wanted to ask right there. And that just helps because, you know, I don't know very much. And so by being a little bit dumb, I just have to keep asking questions. And if I keep asking questions, then, you know, I'm the one asking the stupid questions. And that way, no one else has to feel stupid for asking it. So so that strategy has worked out, rather than trying to take some more. I think the key with everything is not letting the preparation be the stumbling block to starting. I think you just have to start.
Yeah.
And I will say that after, you know, this many years of running the podcast, interviewing, producing, everything, editing, all these other things that I do, I wasn't as good at it when we started. We were good enough and we learned, you know, we got better at it as we did it. And now I think we're pretty good at it.
Yeah, I think it's a process. And and also, I think I can remember that maybe someone told it when I started at the radio station, that this is the golden rule, that you try to be at least as stupid as the most stupid listener. So maybe that sounds strange, but then you ask the right questions, and that's a way to guide and to always find a point where you can start over. And also,
particularly within technical conversations where we are talking about processes that are dense and we're trying to describe them using spoken language, any professional in any kind of field is going to assume a certain amount of knowledge. Mm-hmm. And sometimes assuming that knowledge doesn't help the audience actually gain that knowledge. And so not assuming that has been a positive thing for us.
Yeah. And also, as you mentioned, having the beers with the brewers, that can be also a lot of fun. So I had some episodes where I had like 6, 8, 10 beers together with them. And, you know, brewers tend to empty things. So I can always drink maybe just a little bit, and that's okay. But they normally empty everything. And so I had some episodes where at the end the brewer was very talkative, let's say it like this. But I never had to cut anything. But it's also interesting to just also hear and listen what the mood is changing and the things. And they tell maybe a lot of things that they normally will never do. And that is also an interesting part of it. Yeah. Great. But so now we are here in Poland. And you already had the opportunity to visit some of the breweries. So when we had all these beers in the competition, what is your impression about Poland and the Polish beer world and what you find here?
It is incredibly impressive to me where the Polish craft beer world has gone in the past 15 years, that the Polish craft beer scene almost didn't exist 15 years ago, and that they have built what they have in such a short period of time is pretty incredible, honestly. And, you know, talking with other brewers in Europe in the week, because I was in Belgium for a few days and then in Prague for a night before coming up here to Poland, talking to other brewers, everyone's like, oh, the Polish craft beer scene is great. You know, they were less burdened by some historical traditions. Mm-hmm. You know, Germany had a very highly regimented brewing and beer culture, and so pushing innovation in that kind of space was hard. Czech Republic, strong brewing culture. Mm-hmm. And so people had expectations for what beer could and should be, and here in Poland you know, there was large breweries, people drank beer, but it's, you know, definitely more of a distilled spirit culture. And there was space and open openings for innovation. And the craft brewers came in and found ways to make good, flavorful beer. And there's plenty of brewing knowledge right here in Europe to pull from, but they also weren't burdened by some of the same cultural traditions as some of the countries around them. And so craft beer itself has just flourished here. It's interesting to see. Yeah. And I think the quality of the beer is really tremendous. I wouldn't say I didn't expect it to be, because I have had beer from Polish brewers before coming here. I knew that the beer was going to be good, but it's like every country, there's a normal distribution of, it's a bell curve, right? The question is, how good is the best of the best? And so I think in some beer styles, they're everywhere. They're right up there with the best of the best, Polish brewers won European Beer Star Awards this year. There's plenty that shows that they can play on an international stage.
Yeah, I think it's they are a little bit the mixture of the best approach. So because they have all the creativity and the curiosity and the ideas to do the experiments, which you also find in the American craft brewing scene maybe 20 years ago. But on the other hand, they also have the professionality and the will to make it in a perfect way, like you maybe expect from, let's say, a German brewer, whatever. But they bring that together. So they make crazy, creative, very interesting and just very well done beers. But they do it in a very perfect, professional way. So you can walk in the brewery, you can eat from the floor. It's clean, everything is well kept. So I think this is maybe a little bit the key, because in other countries, maybe you don't have in both. Sometimes you have less creativity or you have less professionality, whatever, the average. But that's something that is really inspiring me in Poland. Wherever you go, you find these guys that really want to make this perfect beer. And this is a great spark, which is in them somehow.
Sure. Yeah. In defense of American brewers, I have been to plenty of American craft breweries where you could also eat off of the floor. Yeah. And so I don't think that... that focus on creativity is mutually exclusive, with that kind of approach. But I know what you're saying. There are certainly, I've there also been to plenty of American breweries where you're like, you make beer here? Yes.
Yeah, I had some examples.
Sure.
But you can find that in Germany too. So
I think that natural distribution happens in every world of brewing, no matter what country you're in. There are the best that are just absolutely beautiful. There are the best that are very regimented and tight. Mm-hmm. And then there's a lot in the middle, some that are creative, some that are more technical. And then there's just some brewers that are like, we run a brewing business here, but
I think maybe it's because they don't have the burden like the German brewers, that you have 20 generations always did that and you have to do it like this. And on the other hand, they have the idea of wanting to make it as good in terms of quality, and so that's in the people. So you also realize it on the judging table. So they are also really taking it serious, and so in general, so I'm really, really also impressed by the Polish beer culture, and as we are impressed, maybe we are already ready for the next beer.
Sure.
I don't know if it's too fast for you, but I'm.
Well, that sounds like a challenge, Mark.
No.
Are you challenging me?
No.
All right, I'm finishing this one.
Maybe one more or two more.
All right, bring it on.
Yeah. So.
You want to stay in hazy IPA or you want something else?
Oh, no, it's on you. So we still have four, but we can go on your side again. But whatever
we've got
you like.
Pinta and we have Moonlark, and I've visited both of those breweries in the last few days. Mm-hmm.
So feel free.
You want to put it on me? Let's try brown beer. Let's go for brown beer. I don't want to miss this one.
Yeah.
Since I have the opportunity to drink it with you.
Mm. So that must be celebrated. Mm. Wow. Oh, the color is already great.
Okay. It's promising. So.
Yeah, and there is smoke.
There is.
Definitely. Mm. And a nice one. It's really like a campfire. Some honey. quite complex, nice foam. So cheers.
Cheers. A beautiful deep copper color. Nicely balanced. Just a little bit of malt sweetness there. Not actually not quite as much as I thought there might be in that. It still it has that sweetness, but still feels like a trim body.
Yeah, 5.7. Just doesn't feel like that. So. Yeah, maybe it's not Bamberg, but it's quite there. No, but good. It's
and that is Moonlark and Rauchbier.
Yeah, one more Rauchbier. Great, 5.7%, and yeah, it's just barley malt. That's it. It's just barley malt mentioned on the can, so it will be perfect. So, but I like it. It's nice. It's an easy drinking beer in terms of the mouthfeel, but with 5.7%, it's just some alcohol.
Yeah.
Nice.
And one more beer is the distributor.
Oh, okay.
So this appears to be a collaboration with the One More Beer distributor.
Thank you for that. Yeah. Perfect. Yeah, it's always, if you have these labels in other languages, it's always hard to guess what is behind that.
I'm going to dig back in. And that One More Beer, is that distribution is also owned by the same ownership of Pinta. So even though Moonlark is an independent, separate brewery.
Yeah, so
there's my story. I have filed away from the last several days of learning about Polish brewers.
Perfect, yeah. And now we are getting into beer trends a little bit. That was also the topic of your talk yesterday. So would you say Rauchbier, smoke beer, is a trend?
I have to say yes. Not because it's true, but because I want it to be true.
Okay, yeah, me too.
And I believe that this is the secret, secret of visualization. That if you want it to be true, you just say it's true enough. And then it becomes true.
So all the audience, close your eyes. Imagine smoke beer is the big new trend. Visualize it. And we will have great beers. Perfect. Yeah. But there is smoke beer in the U.S. also a lot.
Very well.
And I was when I was in Nashville last year. There was even an event during the CBC at one of the breweries, a lot of barrels around, and they only had smoked beers, and it wasn't that bad, so very interesting. It wasn't
that bad. I like it. I like it. That's,
yeah. Yeah, of course, because they made everything with smoke, so it was from the smoky Gose to the smoky quadruple, whatever, everything. And of course, there's maybe some beers you think maybe you could have done something else, but most of them were very nicely. And also, I always say it's not on my opinion, because if the market wants it, if the people drink it, it's perfect. I always find beers I like, so it's okay. But this beer is a wonderful beer that presents the smoky idea without being too pushing. So I think this really is a beer everybody can drink and enjoy that special aroma, which is not in every beer.
Yeah. I think you're right. That's what I have loved about Bamberg smoked beers. That you have this idea, and unfortunately, by the time they get packaged and sit on a ship and get to the United States, they usually have oxidation, and they don't taste as fresh and vibrant as they do in Bamberg. But you know, these beers, while they are smoky, they're not like that. Isn't this like sharp defining factor to them?
Yeah.
They're also full, you know, beautiful, a little bit sweet, a little bit fruity sometimes. You know, and there's that smoke, you know, captures some of that character. It was the most beautiful thing for me to walk through the streets of Bamberg at night, see giant crowds hanging outside of Schlenkerla on this poured out on the street.
Yeah.
And Joe, our executive editor, and I, you know, put our $2 or €2 coin deposit down on glass and got glasses and stood outside and drank them. And, you know, seeing that many people drinking smoked beer, it's like just warmed my heart.
It's a
I show that picture. I took a picture of it and share that picture with American Brewers. Like, you want to see how many people drink smoked beer in Bamberg? This is just an average weekend night in front of Schlenkerla. And most just can't believe it, because the idea of that many people drinking smoked beer is just mind blowing. Like, they just couldn't fathom it. But it does exist, and it's Bamberg is a you know, it's its own separate reality in that regard. And that's why, yeah, that's why brewers love it so much.
Yes, and it's not only about smoked beer. It's in general, course, I think it's one of the very few places in the world where they really live the beer culture in like a daily way.
Right.
So no matter what day, you always, the breweries are full of people. And,
sure.
And they're not always drunk. Sometimes they just have a non-alcoholic beer or whatever else. But it's just they are enjoying the places, the food, the whole culture. This is really, and across my fingers that that can survive, because this is really special and is something that keeps me staying home.
Sure.
So that's always great. But
in the United States, we see breweries like Live Oak in Austin, Texas, that make a deep selection of smoked beers. I was there in, what, I guess it was 2021. They did a smoked beer event, had six smoked beers on tap, you know, whole across a bunch of different styles. Like, being able to taste all that many different smoked beers all at once is just absolutely incredible. One year at the Great American Beer Festival, Live Oak, just the only beers they sent to the festival were four smoked beers.
Wow.
And, you know, they know their audience. And, you know, for fellow brewers, the brewers, yeah, love that, because it's just its own different thing. Dovetail, Chicago, makes some great smoked beers. But, you know, there's a lot of good, you know, there usually it's a beer that the brewers make for themselves. And, you know, usually those beers the brewers make for themselves are some of the best beers the brewers make, because they put the most care into it and they want it to be the most right. They know it's not going to sell a bunch, but they're making it for them, and that's all that matters.
Yeah, and I think people can, when they listen to your podcast, can have a lot of these experiences when you talk to these brewers. So,
yeah.
Just maybe three last things, like takeaways from your presentation. two things I learned, and one thing I'm very curious. So the first learning was there is a West Coast Pilsner.
Yes.
Which is something very strange for a traditional German guy. It was already hard to learn that there is an Italian Pilsner, and it was hard to hear that they want to make a Brazilian Pilsner, but what the hell is a West Coast Pilsner?
It's what you have when you know, take that kind of baseline Pilsner and just add a bunch of American hops to it. I mean, it's just like that. I mean, imagine a West Coast. Well, and I guess we should set the stage. One of the most interesting things about West Coast IPA now is that more and more West Coast IPA in America is being fermented with lager yeast. That it still says IPA, it still says ale in the name of the beer, but it's become much more common amongst the most award-winning brewers to ferment with lager yeast, usually 3470 or something pretty neutral like that, just in order to provide a no ester platform for these hops to carry all of the flavor duty. And it creates just a, you know, slightly more crisply defined IPA. And so now you have West Coast IPA being made with 3470 and usually very light Lovibond malt. And so, you know, you have 1.7, 1.8 Lovibond, you know, Pilsner malt or extra light pale, two-row pale malt. And, you know, so this is what West Coast IPA now looks like now. You know, the last two or three years, this is where it has gone. To win a medal, it just has to be very, very pale, and is usually now made with lager yeast. So that's West Coast IPA. And it's just almost naturally follows from that the West Coast Pils is just going to be a scaled down version of that. You know, it's going to be the same Pilsner malt. And, you know, it's usually American Pilsner malt, not European Pilsner malt. Also, it seems like from what people are saying, the American Pilsner malt tends to kick off less sulfur in fermentation, which, you know, makes actually work pretty much better with some of these, but still very light color, you know, in that 5% ABV range, you know.
So it's like a pale ale. Somehow, in terms of the intensity of the hops, or
that's the funny part, Marcus, because this past year at the Great American Beer Festival, there's a brewery out of Los Angeles, Highland Park Brewery, that makes a beer called Timbo Pils, and Timbo Pils is that prototypical West Coast Pils, and they won a gold medal at the Great American Beer Festival in 2019 in the India Pale Lager category. And then I think it was 2020 or 2021 when they won a bronze medal with the same beer. The category had been changed to like hoppy lager.
Huh.
The year after that, they did a fun collaboration with some brewer friends, and they shared the recipe out with all their brewer friends, and their own brewer friends made the same Timbo Pils recipe, but they did it with their own selected hops.
Mm.
Well, one of those breweries, Pint House in Texas, entered their version of Timbo Pils in the Great American Beer Festival, and they won a silver medal, I believe it was, for that beer in the hoppy lager category, same hoppy lager. So this beer actually has won those medals, actually same beer brewed by two different brewers. Mm-hmm. Well, this past year, Timbo Pils won a gold medal. What category do you think it was in? Knowing it went India Pale Lager, hoppy lager, hoppy lager.
Hmm. And maybe they were as crazy and put it into the pale ale or something.
It won a gold for American pale ale.
Wow.
And you knew this because I said it in my presentation. Yeah, but we were setting the drama up as a good podcast host and guest. We're playing a professional game right here.
That is.
So I'm trying to feed you, the drama here. Yes.
Yeah.
And so it's interesting to watch that evolution, that a beer that would win in a hoppy lager category as a West Coast pils can also really now. It's also, I mean, that's what a lot of judges would lift up as American pale ale, which is just fascinating and interesting.
So let's say the idea or the term IPA or pale ale got away from the technical idea, so you have to use an ale yeast, to an idea of a beer with a crispy, hoppy, bitter, like a canvas for the hops, but less malty thing.
All that matters in this is what customers expect.
Yeah.
And if it meets a customer expectation, that's what you call it. The naming follows the expectation. But it's interesting again, and there are some brewers who cannot get over that to save themselves. Like, we can't, that's an IPL. Like, okay, if you can call it that, if you don't want to sell it, go ahead. I think that it's fair to customers to not bog them down in the jargon based on our technical background and process around these, but instead describe these beers in a way that helps them understand that if they like this, they'll probably like this. Now, there's a whole bunch of other issues with that because what we call American pale ale, Hazy pale ale.
Mm.
It's very similarly named and yet an incredibly different beer.
Yeah.
And so we're confusing people to no end around those things. It's a whole nother issue.
Yeah.
But I think in this regard, it's fascinating and interesting to see that. And of course, no one uses session IPA to describe anything anymore because it just doesn't sound good.
Nope. And it brings us directly to question number two, because normally if you, let's say, ask 100 German beer experts, people, and you say, okay, what is an IPA brewed with lager yeast? They would say it's a cold IPA, but it's not, as we learned yesterday.
It's not a cold IPA unless it includes adjunct. So unless it's got rice and corn in it, we wouldn't call it a cold IPA. And I say we wouldn't call it a cold IPA. Kevin Davey, who created the first cold IPA, wouldn't call it a cold IPA and has said as much to us many, many times. Like, just use adjunct. And the point of cold IPA is to, one, use classic American sea hops more so than modern hops, and to also use adjunct to lighten the body and keep that super light. So, and again, some of these things, whether it was the Highland Park process around brewing lager yeast, brewing IPA with lager yeast, that has also significantly expanded as of late. Right around the same time, Kevin was working on cold IPA and did the same kind of similar kind of, like, some of these things were just happening concurrently in different places. But for us, we just wouldn't call it a cold IPA if it, if it doesn't have adjunct in it.
So the idea is to reduce the malt taste or character even more. So how close are we then to an alcoholic hop water?
Oh, we're still, Have you tasted these? They are so far away from
okay. I just wanted to be curious. Okay. No, I had good cold IPAs in the States, but it's really interesting. If you follow up that track, you end somewhere there. But let's see how it will go.
You would have to drop a lot of malt out of those to get to that kind of point. However, there are brewers making hard hop water now in the United States. We have an article about that in our new brewing industry guide issue.
Mm-hmm.
Great Notion in Portland makes a hard hop water. Pollyanna in Chicago makes a hard hop water. And so, there that exists also. I just,
Okay.
Yeah.
So, and maybe to the last thing we were also talking about yesterday is that there are a lot of new products now, especially hop products and yeast products, which may have the potential to change a lot in the brewing world because you can more easily add aromas or aspects or just things into your beer or even take something out. So how far is that now and how far is it away from the traditional brewing, let's say?
I've been following all of this technology using extracted terpenes and whatnot. And I would say that over the last number of years, that whole technology has improved remarkably. We can actually thank the cannabis industry for some of this extraction and solubilizing technology because they've just been at the forefront of figuring those things out. But now some companies like Abstracts that actually got their start, some great science that they applied initially within the cannabis industry. They've been doing a lot of great work in, extracting terpenes from natural sources, from hops themselves or from, similar natural sources with the same terpenes in them so that they're naturally derived. They're not necessarily synthetic terpenes like that, but building flavor profiles and Haas also has been doing the same kind of thing. What they offer now is actually really interesting and really compelling. A number of years ago, I guess I think it was pre-pandemic, got really interested in this because New Belgium Brewing in Fort Collins brewed a beer called the Hemperer. And it was the goal of that beer was to smell like cannabis when you opened up the bottle. And if you opened up a bottle, everyone in the room would then smell that your beer smelled like cannabis. Like it was so potent and powerful.
Wow.
But they had gone through and thrown cannabis strains into their GC mass spectrometer and looked at the aroma compound spikes for actual cannabis and were able to reconstruct that aromatic profile using naturally derived terpenes that were not cannabis because it wasn't legal to actually use cannabis terpenes in a beer. And, that was, an early, kind of drive down that same kind of pathway. And now we see similar with companies like Haas and Abstracts where they're building, different kinds of profiles, whether they're tropical fruit profiles, whether they're dank cannabis, derived profiles, whether they're, classic berry kind of, like they have done this kind of work to identify what those aroma compounds are using some of these naturally occurring terpenes, and they can reconstruct those, and within beer, I think that time will tell. All things, you go through an initial phase where people are so excited that they do everything and a lot of it sucks. And then you find the things that truly work that make better things and brewers get better at using them. And then they focus less on the tool and more on the product and the result itself. And then you watch those tools become more nuanced and the way the brewers use those tools, become more integrated and wrapped into the thing. And I think that's what's most exciting to me to see. This first generation is going to have a lot of failures and a lot of just, But I think that, within 4 or 5 years, we'll have a really good handle on how to use these in a compelling way that adds to the experience. That makes something better. It doesn't replace hops. It doesn't replace, the work the brewers put into building these things. It simply augments, extends, intensifies, and makes better. And I think, we'll see where that goes. But I'm really interested.
I think it's a lot of alternatives that are now coming to the market. So, for example, they make hop aromas with yeast. so we never saw any hop anyhow, but you, at the end you have aromas you associate with hops. Or now we have the Charles Ferrum here also on the fair, which has also hop aromas made out of plant source, but not hops. And on the other hand, you have a lot of new things made out of hops. So at the fair in Nuremberg, we even had hop popcorn or hop water and other things. So I think there's just a lot of things which are now tried out and being made, and let's see what it brings. So it's great to always have a look also in the future of brewing without losing the basis. And so I'm very happy that we had the opportunity to talk. And I can only invite our audience to watch for your magazine, to listen to your podcast, and to maybe visit you somewhere in the States. So it was great having you here. And thanks a lot for the great beers, too.
Thank you so much, Marcus. It's been my pleasure.
Beer Talk, der Podcast rund ums Bier. Alle Folgen unter www.biertalk.de.